Hello and welcome to today's reading of the New York Times. We'll start with a front page article from the Tuesday, May 7th edition. It carries the headline, Israeli tanks enter Rafah and take control of border crossing. Before the overnight assault in Gaza, Israel warned 110,000 people to evacuate and launched airstrikes against what it called Hamas targets. Military officials said the scope of the operation was limited. Here are the latest developments. The Israeli military said on Tuesday that it had sent tanks into Rafah and established control over the Gaza side of the border crossing with Egypt in what it called a limited operation aimed at destroying Hamas targets it says were used to attack Israeli soldiers. The incursion did not appear to be a long-promised ground invasion of Rafah, which Israel's allies have been working to avert by pushing for a ceasefire deal. It came after a dizzying day that saw Israel order people to evacuate parts of the city. Then Hamas claims that it had accepted the terms of a ceasefire, followed by an announcement by Israel's military that it was carrying out, quote, targeted strikes, end quote, in eastern Rafah. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing pressure to agree to a ceasefire with Hamas that is backed by the United States and Arab nations, and that would secure the release of hostages still being held in Gaza. His government said that it would send negotiators to Cairo on Tuesday. The Israeli military called Tuesday's incursion a very precise counterterrorism operation and declined to say how long it planned to stay in Rafah. Troops found three tunnel shafts in the area near the crossing, and about 20 militants were killed during the operation, it said in a statement. Israel has long viewed Gaza's border with Egypt as a main route for smuggling arms into the coastal enclave. The incursion on Tuesday and airstrikes the day before mark an increase in the fighting after Israel withdrew most of its forces from Gaza Strip in April. Israel's campaign has forced almost all of Gaza's population to flee their homes. Many have gone to Rafah, where large numbers of people have been living in squalid tent camps. On Monday evening, Antonio Guterres, UN Secretary General, said again that, quote, a ground invasion in Rafah would be intolerable because of its devastating humanitarian consequences and because of its destabilizing impact in the region. Also, on Monday, Israel told more than 100,000 Gazans in eastern Rafah to flee ahead of airstrikes. An invasion of Rafah, where more than a million Gazans have fled during the war, has been a point of tension for Mr. Netanyahu and his closest international allies. The United States has warned him not to launch an invasion without a credible plan to protect Rafah's population. And ground and air forces were also operating overnight in a neighborhood of eastern Rafah near the border crossing, the military said. It did not specify the location of the tunnel shafts or where the fighters had been killed. And an Associated article, Inside the White House Scrambled to Broker a Deal in Gaza. The flurry of actions underscores how fluid the situation in the region is as President Biden and his team try to ultimately end the war that has devastated Gaza. Over the course of a few hours, the news from the Middle East came into the White House Situation Room fast and furious. Israel orders 100,000 civilians out of Rafah in prelude to invasion. Hamas, quote-unquote, accepts ceasefire deal, potentially precluding invasion. Israel conducts strikes against Rafah, possibly opening invasion. The war is on, off, on again. Developments on Monday left White House officials scrambling to track what was happening and what it all meant. At the end of the day, they came to believe each of the moves signaled less than originally met the eye, but reflected efforts to gain leverage at the negotiating table with a clear resolution not yet in sight. In fact, Hamas did not, quote-unquote, accept a ceasefire deal so much as make a counteroffer to the proposal on the table, previously blessed by the United States and Israel. A counteroffer that was not itself deemed acceptable, but a sign of progress. At the same time, Israel strikes in Rafah evidently were not the start of the long-threatened major operation, but targeted retaliation for Hamas rocket attacks that killed four Israeli soldiers over the weekend, and along with the warning to civilians, a way to increase pressure on Hamas negotiators. The flurry of actions underscored how fluid the situation in the region is as President Biden and his team try to broker a deal that they hope will ultimately end the war that's devastated Gaza, killed tens of thousands of combatants and civilians, inflamed the region, and provoked unrest in American college campuses. Over the last few days, the talks went from high hopes that a deal was close to a fresh impasse that seemed to leave them on the verge of collapse, to a renewed initiative by Hamas to get them back on track. Biden is continuing all efforts to thread multiple needles at once, said Mara Rudman, former Deputy Middle East Special Envoy under President Barack Obama, who is now at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. The president is still warning Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel that a Rafah ground invasion is a terrible idea, she said, while also pressuring Hamas in every way possible to get hostages out and more humanitarian aid in. Mr. Biden called Mr. Netanyahu on Monday to fill him in on American assessment of where the ceasefire talks stand and to again press the Israeli leader to hold off any full-fledged attack on Rafah. The president also hosted lunch at the White House with King Abdullah II of Jordan, who, like other Arab leaders, is eager to bring the war to an end. The past 2 weeks have been as intense and as suspenseful diplomatically as any since Hamas mounted a major terrorist attack on Israel on October 7th, killing an estimated 1,200 people, taking more than 200 hostages. After months of stalemated talks, Israel came back on April 26th with a proposal that American officials believed to change the dynamics and offered a serious chance for agreement. Under the first phrase of the proposal, Israel would halt the war for 42 days and release hundreds of Palestinians held in its prisons, while Hamas would release 33 hostages, specifically women, older men, the sick, and wounded. The number 33 was an increase from 18 proposed by Hamas, but lower than the 40 originally demanded by Israel, in large part because Israeli officials came to understand that they were not more than 33 hostages who met the criteria, according to people informed about the discussions who insisted on anonymity to describe sensitive talks. Indeed, Hamas revealed to the Israelis on Monday that the 33 would include the remains of hostages who had died, as well as those still living. In addition, Israel would pull its forces out of populated areas of Gaza and permit Gazans to return to the northern part of the enclave once conditions were met. To that end, the ceasefire would enable a large increase in the flow of humanitarian aid. In trying to call Hamas's bluff, people informed on the talks said the Israelis virtually cut and pasted some of the language from Hamas's proposal in March and put it into theirs. Another article from today's New York Times. Campus protests. MIT orders encampment cleared, and Columbia cancels Maine commencement. Tensions were rising at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology on Monday after pro-Palestinian demonstrators resisted an order from the school to clear their encampment, leading to some skirmishes between the protesters and the police. The entrenched protest movement was also causing disruptions to university commencements, with Columbia announcing cancellation of its Maine ceremony. The move came after a weekend in which student activism was on display at several graduation events alongside the usual pomp. Weeks of demonstrations that led to police raids and arrests on several campuses, including at least 100 more at California schools on Monday morning, have spilled into the streets of graduation season, with protests over the war in Gaza briefly disrupting some ceremonies over the weekend. Dozens of new arrests in recent days have raised the total number of people detained on campuses to more than 2,500 at nearly 50 schools since April 18th, according to a New York Times tally. Here's what else to know. Columbia officials cited security as a main reason for canceling its large commencement ceremony. The school will still hold smaller events for each of its 19 colleges, mostly at its athletic complex some 100 blocks north of its main campus, which the university has said is a crime scene. It has been in a state of near lockdown since last Tuesday. Also, police in riot gear removed a pro-Palestinian encampment early Sunday from the campus of the University of Southern California for the second time in recent weeks. Against this tense backdrop, The university will hold a modified celebration on Thursday in the place of its main graduation ceremony. More arrests were made on Monday at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the University of California, San Diego. Other schools across the country have adjusted their ceremonies or increased security. Emory University announced on Monday that it was moving its university-wide commencement, as well as diploma ceremonies for its 9 schools, to an indoor complex off campus. At the University of Chicago, student protesters have remained at their encampment for a week as students and officials spent the weekend negotiating over its removal. And a group of professors at the University of Virginia signaled an open letter condemning the treatment of pro-Palestinian students and faculty on Saturday when police in riot gear sprayed demonstrators with chemical irritants. Dozens of demonstrators held up Palestinian flags at the University of Michigan graduation on Saturday. Some students marched toward the stage before being stopped by police. At Northeastern University on Sunday, one student wearing a kefir and a shirt reading "Divest" ran up to the stage. Moving to our next article, Trump is threatened with jail at his criminal trial. 5 takeaways. Prosecutors on Monday took the jury deep into the Trump Organization's ledgers as the state's case proceeded at speed. Donald Trump's Monday began with a grave warning from Juan Marchand, the judge presiding over the former president's criminal trial, threatening to imprison him if he continued to flout a gag order. Justice Marchand said the fines levied against Mr. Trump, $10,000 so far, are, quote, not serving as a deterrent, end quote. The judge said that, therefore, going forward, this court will have to consider jail. That warning preceded a desert-dry description of a $130,000 payment made by Mr. Trump's fixer, Michael Cohen, to a porn star to buy his silence about her story of a one-night stand in 2006. That testimony was elicited from 2 employees, one current, one retired, of the Trump Organization. Former president is accused of falsifying business records to cover up that $130,000 payment. Mr. Trump, 77, the first American president to face criminal prosecution, has denied the charges and says he did not have sex with the woman, Stormy Daniels. If convicted, he could face prison time or probation. Here are 5 takeaways for Mr. Trump's 12th day on the trial. Trump's comments continue to bring him trouble. Justice Marchand once again found Mr. Trump in contempt for violating his gag order that prohibited attacks on jurors, witnesses, court staff, and others. It was Mr. Trump's 10th violation, resulted from an April 22nd interview in which he said the jury was from, quote, a purely Democratic area, end quote, calling those circumstances very unfair. The violation resulted in a $1,000 fine, which was on top of a $9,000 he was fined last week for 9 other violations, a pittance for a billionaire. But the comments by Justice Marchand, who called the repeated violations a direct attack on the rule of law, may have a far greater impact. Justice Marchand said he recognized what a disruption and dramatic decision jailing Mr. Trump would be, but made clear he would imprison him if necessary. "You're the former president," the judge said, adding, "and possibly the next president," but he added, "at the end of the day, I have a job to do." A chastened Mr. Trump seethes. As Justice Marchand admonished Mr. Trump, the former president hunched over the defense table, staring at him. When he finished, Mr. Trump shook his head. After court, Mr. Trump again blasted the trial as election interference in comments in the hallway outside the courtroom. "They want to keep me off the trail," said Mr. Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, adding he had hoped the trial might end on Monday. Mr. Trump did perk up when Jeffrey McConney, the Trump Organization's former corporate controller, recounted when Mr. Trump told him, as a joke, that he was fired because of a dip in his cash balances. Mr. Trump smiled at the memory. The jury saw evidence of Michael Cohen's payments. Mr. McConney testified about reimbursing Mr. Cohen for his payments to Ms. Daniels. He was ultimately paid $420,000, which included a bonus and money to offset taxes, an arrangement outlined in a handwritten note by Mr. McConney shown to jurors. Paid over a year, the hush money amounted to $35,000 a month. The schedule was painstakingly documented by prosecutors, who showed invoices Mr. Cohen sent to the Trump Organization and checks to Mr. Cohen. Mr. Cohen's invoices mentioned a retainer agreement, something that prosecutors say didn't exist, rather was a way to disguise the reimbursement. On Monday, Mr. McConney was asked if he saw such an agreement. Mr. McConney replied, "I did not." And it was dull, but it was important. Mr. McConney and another witness, Deborah Tarasoff, an accounts supervisor at the Trump Organization, both testified about internal machinations to pay back Mr. Cohen. Prosecutors asked them to identify a raft of business records and other forms to authenticate and describe them. After a week that had set a sensational backdrop for the case, including the presidential race in 2016 and the frantic efforts to keep stories about the extramarital affairs quiet, Monday's testimony was often soporific. Notably, Ms. Tarasoff also testified about the checks to Michael Cohen, which account for business records, which prosecutors say were falsified. But the slog was necessary for prosecutors hoping to hang a case on documents. Still, Mr. Trump didn't seem impressed, keeping his eyes closed for some of it, as he has for swaths of testimony on other days. Our next article: a new diplomatic strategy emerges as artificial intelligence grows. The new U.S. approach to cyber threats comes as early optimism about a global internet connecting the world has been shattered. American and Chinese diplomats plan to meet later this month to begin what amounts to the first tentative arms control talks over the use of artificial intelligence. A year in the making, the talks in Geneva are an attempt to find some common ground on how AI will be used and in which situations it could be banned. For example, in the command and control of each country's nuclear arsenals. The fact that Beijing agreed to the discussion at all was something of surprise, since it has refused any discussion of limiting the size of nuclear arsenals themselves. But for the Biden administration, the conversation represents a first serious foray into the new realm of diplomacy, which Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about on Monday in a speech in San Francisco at the RSA conference, Silicon Valley's annual convention on both the technology and the politics of securing cyberspace. It's true that move fast and break things is literally the exact opposite of what we try to do at the State Department, Mr. Blinken told the thousands of cyber experts, coders, and entrepreneurs, a reference to the Silicon Valley mantra about technological disruption. But it is that disruption, from a quickening pace of sophisticated cyber attacks to the vulnerability of undersea cables to the battle for control of the internet and the influence of operations it enables, that has driven agencies across the government to design strategies for dealing with emerging technology threats. Biden White House issued a national strategy for dealing with cyber. Pentagon has written one focused on deterring attacks. The Department of Homeland Security honed in on resilience. But the last formal State Department strategy for diplomatic engagement on the topic was written a dozen years ago, in President Barack Obama's first term. Ransomware was not yet a scourge, and the technology behind ChatGPT was still years away. While cyber attacks were well underway, including some launched by U.S. intelligence agencies, they had not become a daily staple of geopolitical competition. But the new strategy comes at a time when the early optimism about a global internet connecting the world has been shattered. What is left is what Nathaniel Fick, State Department's first ambassador for cyberspace and digital policy, who is expected to play a key role in the discussions with China, refers to as a, quote, fragmented system, end quote, that is unlikely to ever be sewn back together. Just about everyone is willing to acknowledge that the technology is an important element of foreign policy, but I would argue that tech is not just part of the game. It is increasingly the entire game, Mr. Frick said in an interview. Think about it. Asymmetric advantage in the war in Ukraine, global competition with China on key technologies, the ability of Israel and its allies to intercept Iranian aerial attacks. All tech, he said. The international order will be defined by whose metaphorical operating system dominates. Mr. Frick's strategy, written with Adam Siegel, on Council on Foreign Relations expert on cyber, whom Mr. Frick brought into the State Department's new Cyber and Digital Bureau to help write the strategy, focuses on the concept of digital solidarity with allies and partner states that have a common view of the rules that should govern technology and information flows. We have to hang together with allies and partners, truly investing in digital solidarity, or we'll get picked apart by those who have a very different view of tech's role in the world, Mr. Frick said, clear reference to the growing partnership of Russia and China. As a result, the strategy goes beyond the rules of managing cyber conflict and focuses on American efforts to assure control over physical technologies like undersea cables, which connect countries, companies, and individual users to cloud services. Huawei, the Chinese telecommunications giant, has been seeking to dominate the laying of cables across the Pacific and increasingly around the world. But Mr. Frick maintains the American, Japanese, and European firms still dominate the market, and this remains one area where we can compete vigorously. Mr. Blinken, in his speech, made clear that part of the diplomacy he envisions involves persuading nations not to rely on undersea cables, data storage, or cloud computing supplies from Chinese suppliers or other states in China's technological orbit. He describes an increasingly zero-sum competition in which countries will be forced to choose between signing up for a Western-dominated, quote-unquote, stack of technologies or a Chinese-dominated one. In these arenas, the United States currently leads the world, but providers from authoritarian states are increasingly competitive, Mr. Blinken told the RSA conference. It's critical we work with trusted vendors and exclude untrustworthy ones from the ecosystem. Mr. Blinken made clear, by implication, that it was China's firms he was labeling as untrustworthy. And now let's move to today's Metro section. Uncle regrets saying some black kids don't know the word computer. As Governor Kathy Hochul urged business leaders to make technology widely accessible, a comment she made about Bronx children raised eyebrows. At the Milken Institute Global Conference, annual gathering of billionaires and business leaders in California, Governor Kathy Hochul of New York was given a spotlight on Monday to expound on her new artificial intelligence initiative. But as she explained her desire to make technology more widely accessible, especially in low-income communities, the governor made an extemporaneous comment suggesting that black children from the Bronx were unfamiliar with computers. In an exchange with moderator Jonathan Capehart, Ms. Hochul said that right now we have young black kids growing up in the Bronx who don't even know what the word computer is. Ms. Hochul, Democrat, did not immediately correct her gaffe. Instead, she went on to explain that her goal of providing more access to technology would spur innovation and help address societal inequity. The governor on Monday evening expressed contrition over her word choice, saying that she misspoke, and I regret it, adding that her focus was on increasing economic opportunity. Of course, black children in the Bronx know what computers are, she said in a statement. The problem is that they too often lack access to the technology needed to get on track to high-paying jobs in emerging industries like AI. This is not the first time this year the governor's rhetorical style has led to unwelcome attention. In February, Ms. Hochul referred to hypothetical destruction of Canada to imply that Israel had a right to destroy Gaza in retaliation for the October 7th attacks. If Canada someday ever attacked Buffalo, I'm sorry, my friends. There would be no Canada the next day, she said then. She quickly apologized for her, quote, poor choice of words, end quote, and said she regretted her inappropriate analogy. A remark at the Milken Conference, which was held at the stately Beverly Hills Hotel in Los Angeles, seemed consistent with her blunt, folksy style that can occasionally veer into caricature. Also from today's Metro section, congestion pricing's billions to pay for nuts and bolts of subway system. The $15 billion expected from new traffic tolls is earmarked for modernizing old infrastructure, but is threatened by a raft of lawsuits. New York City's congestion pricing program is scheduled to begin charging tolls to drive into the busiest parts of Manhattan next month, with the aim of generating a $15 billion windfall for the mass transit system. That money would not translate into lower fares or a huge subway expansion. Instead, with a few notable exceptions, it would largely support the unglamorous but critical work of maintaining the century-old infrastructure that millions of New Yorkers rely on, repairing and upgrading aging equipment, modernizing signals and technology, and making subway stations more accessible. The Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which oversees congestion pricing, has already earmarked the entire $15 billion for long-planned projects, but now the money is in jeopardy as legal challenges to the plan threaten to blow a significant hole in the MTA's budget. Congestion pricing, which is due to begin June 30th, is the single largest source of funding for the transit agency's $51.5 billion capital program, accounting for nearly 30% of the total. Since congestion pricing has yet to get off the ground, the MTA used other funding first for its capital program, and now that $15 billion accounts for half the money the authority is expecting to finance its remaining projects. The point is, this is the money they are counting on right now, said Andrew Rain, president of the Citizens Budget Commission watchdog group, who sees these repairs and improvements as essential. In addition to the infrastructure work, the most notable upgrades would include shiny new cars on the subway and commuter train lines, and the funding would also mean progress on extending the Second Avenue subway to East Harlem. Seven lawsuits have been brought in federal court in New York and New Jersey by opponents, including New Jersey Governor Philip Murphy, over the cost of the new tolls, as well as concerns that, as drivers skirt around them, traffic and pollution could shift to other areas. The courts could rule before the tolls begin, possibly delay or upend the program at the last minute. Amid the legal uncertainty, MTA officials have temporarily halted new contracts for all but the most urgent construction. Of $12 billion in projects that have been planned for this year, officials now expect to commit to just $2.9 billion in contracts. Jamie Torres Springer, the MTA's construction and development president, said in a recent committee meeting that unless investments continue to be made in the capital program, we can return to the bad old days and see service decline. There are many benefits of congestion pricing, including reducing traffic, but it was the billions that would pour into mass transit that pushed state lawmakers to approve it in 2019 after a series of subway meltdowns underscored the need for repairs. And that's all we have time for today. I've been reading from the Tuesday, May 7th edition of the New York Times. We thank you for listening. So long until next time.